Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing. We're going to talk about how much meat should we reduce in consumption in order to help meet some climate target changes. Then there are some environmental toxicants causing ovarian disease across generations. We'll share those with you so you can avoid them. Also, what causes cancer to really grow in the body? New information on that, which we talked about a long time ago based upon the work of Dr. Otto Warburg, but it's new now. And also, what happens when a man's testosterone gets too low, and how can we get it back up to normal? There are consequences for that. We'll share that. My guest early on in today's program for a short newsmaker interview will be Dr. Martha Herbert. She's an assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and a pediatric neurologist at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And we're going to talk with her about the autistic epidemic, but advances in nutritional therapy. Finally, they're catching up, and that's good. And she will be joined with Julie Matthews. And Julie is also a major activist out there doing a lot to help educate people. She's a certified nutritional consultant specializing in autistic spectrum disorders and founder of Nourishing Hope, dedicated to treating autism through nutritional means. And she's in San Francisco. Well, they're both in San Francisco today, so we'll speak with him about the latest on that. That's good. Then from our issue segment, I have three. I'll share these and ask you then to call in and share your points of view on each. One is, this is from John Kneffel from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR. Media getting bored with Occupy and inequality. We'll deal with that. Then from Glenn Greenwald, this is very important. Celebrating our warrior president, one of the most militarily aggressive American leaders in decades, being praised in the New York Times for being hard-hitting. We'll share with you what Glenn Greenwald has to say, and then you can speak back. Also today, environmentalism has failed. Biocentric view is needed. From David Suzuki from Fundamental Failure of the Environmentalism, EchoWatch.com. And I'll be sharing some insights from the Washington blog on how our country is being fracked by the merger of government and big business and why that is not a good thing. In effect, the government today is using its police powers to protect gas hydrofracking. So those are our issues that I'm going to talk about. And some positive insight, if they're willing to listen to it, from Kerry Gillam from The Guardian on what we can do to stop genetically engineered foods from getting into our food supply. As you see, we have a whole lot, and I've written 16 commentaries I'll be doing over the next 16 programs, a new one each day for myself, as well as those who I consider very progressive in their thoughts. Let's begin. This is important new research from Dr. Michael Smith, a medical doctor, and here's what he says. Looking to lose a little weight? If that's the case, according to recent published clinical trial, you should try green coffee beans. Now, we're not talking about drinking coffee with its caffeine to lose weight. That's different. We're talking about, with this study, an extract derived from the green bean of the coffee. These young coffee beans are rich in chlorogenic acid, an antioxidant currently known for helping to tame blood sugar spikes. As it turns out, that same chlorogenic acid can also help you to drop some pounds. And it talked about the study. So you can buy these in health food stores. There are different companies making them. What it is just to get the organic green coffee bean extract if you've had trouble losing weight, and that can help you. Next up meat consumption, and let's just say that you're not going to stop eating meat, and most people are not. From the Food Navigator, USA.com, meat consumption would need to be reduced by 50% per person in order to meet nitrogen levels or nitrous oxide reduction targets. And that's according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The research is led by Dr. Eric Davidson and published in Environmental Research Letters. And what it does is this. It simply says, what are the most common ways that we create heat in the environment, leading to global warming, which leads to climate instability? Well, meat. So if we're able to reduce our reliance on meat, then that means those animals wouldn't be polluting the environment, and that means we would have less global warming. So there's a big reason for each person who is eating meat to eat none or less. And if you don't want to give it up, okay, that's your right and that's your choice. I won't argue that issue. What I will argue is, how about doing something for the environment, for all of us, for the common air we all breathe and the land we're all using? Because that's a good thing when you can reduce your consumption of beef. Forget the health consequences for a moment. I've outlined those 1,000 times. This is about the environment, and that's going to help all of us. So lower your intake of meat by 50%, and you will help us. Helping people with ovarian diseases is a challenge, but we have to do it every day because so many women have ovarian disease. This is the latest from Science Daily. It was done at Washington State University, and researchers found that ovarian disease can result from exposure to a wide range of environmental chemicals and actually be inherited by future generations. Washington State University reproductive biologist Michael Skinner and his colleagues found how fungicides, pesticides, plastic, dioxin, hydrocarbon mixtures affect a gestating rat's multiple generations and their reproductive organs. And it's known as epigenetics. Now, you've heard me mention epigenetics in different contexts, but this is how epigenetics regulates how genes are turned on and off in tissue and cells. And 3 generations were affected, showing fewer ovarian follicles, the source of eggs, and increasing polycystic ovarian disease. What this means is simple. Ancestral environmental exposures and epigenetics play a significant role in making you more likely to have ovarian disease. Quote, what your great-grandmother was exposed to when she was pregnant may promote ovarian disease in you, and you're going to pass it on to your grandchildren. Ovarian disease has been increasing over the past few decades to affect more than 10% of the human female population, and environmental epigenetics may provide a reason for this increase. And this was published in a major journal. Now, here's my take on this. I believe that we should look in a positive mindset to changing our life. Most people don't have to be anywhere the rest of their lives. So where do you choose to be, and under what circumstances are you living in that environment will determine the quality of your life. Those who can get to the country, who can eat organic, who can take in the calories they need but not more, the protein they need, which I discussed yesterday. I talked about how the average restaurant now is feeding you 300% more protein in a given meal than your body actually requires in a whole day, which means that you're more susceptible to damage to your liver and your kidneys, including the astronomical epidemic of something you almost never hear discussed today, which is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which leads to severe liver disease. That's when you take in too much protein. Now, think of all the tens of millions of Americans who are on the high-protein diets to lose weight. They may have lost a little weight, but boy, did they pay a price because of the byproducts. So, looking towards the future and creating the resources that you need to get there, plan over the next 12 to 36 months of spending more time in the country, more time detoxing, bringing more healthy nutrients in, especially the green juices, more berries, and surrounding yourself with more positive people. all that will make a difference on changing that genetic predisposition to a disease, including ovarian disease. But if you keep doing the same thing to grandparents, parents, and you do, then you're all going to be suffering from the same type of conditions, and you just pass it on. You can break that, but you have to detoxify also, and that's doable. I remember the first time that I was working with a terminal cancer patient, and I was reading at that time the work of Dr. Otto Warburg, who won 2 Nobel Prizes in physiology. And he was suggesting that people at higher altitudes suffer from less cancer, and partly because how the body utilized oxygen. Well, of course, there's less oxygen the higher up you go, but therefore you have to breathe deeper, you have a greater lung capacity, and your blood is much more oxygen-rich. We've seen that with Sherpas and the Himalayas and people living at high altitudes. In fact, around the world, as a group, the longest-lived people are those who live at the highest altitudes. And then I started to look at the opposite. What happens in a fermentative medium where you don't get the exercise, you're sedentary, and the foods that you consume are not oxygenated. They're devoid of that essential oxygen or devoid of enzymes. They're not empowering foods. They're not vital foods. And then, of course, you start seeing the higher levels of disease. So therefore, the higher the oxygen level, through exercise or hyperbaric oxygen therapy, for example, the less cancer is able to grow. And, of course, people mock that for a long period of time, saying, well, there's no real proof of that. Here's the latest from Science Daily as of this morning. This is from the University of Georgia. Quote, low oxygen levels could drive cancer growth. Low oxygen levels in cells may be a primary cause of uncontrollable tumor growth in some cancers, according to a new University of Georgia study. The author's findings run contrary to widely accepted beliefs that genetic mutations are responsible for cancer growth. If hypoxia, or low oxygen levels in cells, is proven to be a key driver of certain types of cancer treatments, plans for curing the malignant growth could change in significant ways. And this was presented in the Journal of Molecular Cell Biology. So what this means is exactly what those in the alternative field have been doing. High oxygen, and hence hyperbaric, as a way of helping people with cancer, and vigorous aerobic exercise, and taking in nutrients like vitamin E and tocotrienols and coenzyme Q10 and DMG and TMG and these other highly methylated B12 and folic acid, these are actually anti-cancer, both in prevention and in treatment. So all along, they were in the wrong direction, and now they've gotten a little course correction, which is good. Now, a lot of men complain about having low testosterone levels, and that's not good because most of the time they will suffer in silence. First, they'll start to develop abdominal fat. They'll lose muscle mass. They'll start to see their skin shriveling. They won't have their libido. And worst of all, it affects their emotions, so there's no longer the same emotional connection with the things they enjoyed before or even the people. And so then people begin to challenge them of what's wrong with you, and they don't know what's wrong with themselves. All they know is something's not the same as it was before. So low testosterone levels are bad. Here's one more reason to be concerned, and this is why I'm suggesting men over the age of 35 have your testosterone, especially your free testosterone, checked. This is in the University of Edinburgh. I'll quote this. Low levels of testosterone in men could increase the risk of developing diabetes. Scientists have found that low testosterone levels are linked to a resistance in insulin, the hormone that controls blood sugar levels. The study is the first to directly show how low testosterone levels in fat tissue can be instrumental in the onset of type 2 diabetes. Now, low testosterone levels are also, we know, linked to obesity. And we know that obesity is linked to diabetes. and it acts on fat cells through molecules known as androgen receptors, and these enable the testosterone to activate genes linked to diabetes and obesity. So what do we do? Well, the first thing we do is exercise. The best thing in the world you can do to stimulate human growth hormone and testosterone is do 6 days a week of aerobic exercise for about an hour a day. Then Crisin, Miropuama, oat straw, lots of good nutrients that you can take. Ginseng also help stimulate testosterone levels. That's the latest on health and healing. Now to our issues before we go to our guest. Then we'll have our guest on. Then we'll come back for your calls. And today I'm throwing a lot of different issues at you. And I will hold my comments until your calls, except for one. This is from John Kenefell. And here's what he says. Occupy Wall Street is rightly credited with helping to shift the economic debate in America from a fixation on deficits to issues of income inequality, corporate greed, and the centralization of wealth among the richest 1%. The movement has chalked up other victories as well, from altering New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's tax plan to re-energizing activists and unions, but bringing some discussion of class into the mainstream dialogue has been one of its growing achievements. However, he says that the Occupy movement is losing interest on the part of the mainstream media and the mainstream public. It's even getting a little worse, unfortunately, and that's if you watch Bill O'Reilly or everyone on the right, they're taking those really minuscule percentage who are acting out in violent ways, breaking property, fighting, throwing things, and then focusing upon those as if to smear all the nonviolent protesters, and the vast majority are nonviolent, and the vast majority young people who have ideals and are concerned are out there doing what anyone who has some ideals and concerns should do, you know, actively, nonviolently protest. Now, the problem, as I saw it, this is my own personal opinion, is that there was no central theme. There was no group of individuals who could speak articulately on the issue, and there was no organizing force that could cause legislative change. Having been an activist my entire adult life, even as a teenager, my hometown, I appreciate what happens when people come together. And when I suggested this on at least 30 occasions when I was down at Occupy, and we were there on the very first day and actually did a show with him and filmed it and put it up on the internet the next day, I suggested that they would have much more influence if they worked towards common causes. Now, jump ahead. Historically, with 5,000 different environmental groups, some very large, some tiny, some working out of their house with no funding, all of them had their idea of what should be changed. And probably all of them are correct in varying degrees. Then why is there so little that actually gets changed? Because of a lack of cooperation, a lack of joining together for a common cause. Can it be done? Let me give you three examples. Working with various groups, we had anti-fracking, anti-nuclear, and anti-genetic engineering groups and their leadership all together in front of the governor's office, on the West Side Highway Park, and in Brooklyn, in Washington for a demonstration. At least 80% of those were from our audience, because I asked from the stage how many are here from different groups, and there was our radio audience. Here's how it went, just so you know what went on behind the scenes. I would speak with the people, and I would say, look, your movement is important, and I know that you're all working hard, but what if we all work together for 3 months at a time on a single issue, and the best minds, the most articulate people, the people who could really debate this well and educate the public, were the ones who were called upon to lead the rallies and meet with the press or do the debates, and then have others write the articles and put up the research and showing that these are legitimate concerns. And people agreed. As a result, it wasn't just anti-nuclear, it wasn't just anti-fracking, or it wasn't just anti-genetic engineering. Combining together and being consistent. For example, we got our permits. And the police, because we were, you know, honoring them as well, they're human beings. They're not the enemy. You've got some stupid people, and you've got some stupid police. You've got excessive people overacting in both. But the vast majority aren't. And as a result, when the crowds kept growing, instead of saying, no more, get out of here, and there being a problem, they kept opening the barricades until finally the entire block we had. And at the end, I gave copies of the papers and the films to the police because they asked for them, including the lieutenant. Says, hey, this is something that interests me because I live only 8 miles from Indian Point. I didn't know any of this stuff. You know, I thank you all for coming here and educating us. And he said, and all the other police here, about 14 police, said, we didn't know this stuff. Now we do. I don't know what that person is going to do with it, but they're a human being who can share something. And if you deal with people at the human level instead of objects of disdain, a lot can get done. This is the latest of what happens when you work together, when multiple groups and multiple people bring their passion as one. Quote, groups push for vote on GMO food labels. Reuters from Carrie Gilman. A California initiative to require labeling of food containing genetically modified ingredients appears headed for the ballot in November after organizers said on Wednesday they'd gathered 1 million signatures in favor of the measure. The hotly contested proposal is similar to measures being pushed in other states, by the way, Vermont's one, and at the federal level, as GMO opponents demand more transparency in food products. The California measure would require labeling of foods made with biotech corn, soybeans, canola, and other biotech crops to specify that they are, quote, produced with genetically engineering, end quote. More than 971,000 people signed the Right to Know petition, far more than the 555,000 needed to qualify for the November 6th ballot. Now, there are spokespersons. There are people who are leading that effort. We use our KPFK sister station, the six-hour show done for 29 years every Wednesday morning, to get people to get behind this, people in this audience behind it, over the internet behind it, publishing for over 2 years, over 300 anti-GMO articles, documentaries, videos, meetings, and now we're going to be on the ballot. And now California will probably pass this, and now a person will have a choice of saying, do I want to buy a product or not? Imagine the impact that can have then on activists in all the different states. That will give a devastating defeat to Monsanto, DuPont, and the other genetically modified companies. Why? Because we worked together. Had we not all worked together, this wouldn't have happened. Now imagine what we're doing in other areas, like vaccines. We're working together. I would hope, and my suggestion is, that the people in the Occupy movement find one idea, and for 3 months make that the idea. How about getting interest loans at zero for all students or going on general strike at all the colleges in the United States to demand the forgiveness of all late compounded and penalties on interest that is staggering, and then demand that a person be allowed by bankruptcy to change the law so that they're not A, arrested, because right now students who don't pay their college tuition can be thrown in jails, and 16 states now have debtors' prison reintroduced. You heard me right. It is a fact. People are being put into prison today because they didn't pay a bill, any kind of bill. So there's something that would manifest for younger people who could appreciate the importance of it, the significance of it. So you could do multiple things, get them out of a debt peonage, get them to be able to file for bankruptcy if they qualify, and get rid of all compounded and late debt. Remember, the best thing in the world for the banking community is for you not to be able to pay your interest or to be late because they just compound it, and you end up in their pocket. That's something worthwhile. Otherwise, I fear that in time, it'll dissipate into nothingness. Now, the one thing that I'm very concerned about, and many of these listeners of this program is concerned about, is celebrating militarization. This is from Glenn Greenwald. I will give my own comments afterwards. This is from a titled article, Celebrating Our Warrior President, One of the Most Military Aggressive American Leaders in Decades. It's a short article. Quote, Peter Bergen, the director of national security studies at the Democrat Party-supported New American Foundation, has a long op-ed in the New York Times today glorifying President Obama as a valiant and steadfast warrior president. It begins this way. The president who won the Nobel Prize less than 9 months ago after his inauguration has turned out to be one of the most military aggressive American leaders in decades. Now just ponder that. Not only the Democratic Party, but also its progressive faction, is wildly enamored of, quote, one of the most military aggressive American leaders in decades. That's quite revealing on multiple levels. Bergen does note the irony. He recalls that Obama used his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech to defend the justifications for war and points out, quote, if those on the left were listening, they didn't care. He adds that the left, which had loudly condemned George Bush for waterboarding and due process violations at Guantanamo, was quiet when the Obama administration acted as judge and executioner, ordering more than 250 drone strikes in Pakistan since 2009, during which at least 1,400 lives were lost. To explain the behavior of the left, Bergen offers this theory. From both the right and the left, there has been a continuing dramatic cognitive disconnect between Obama's record and the public perception of his leadership. Despite his demonstrated willingness to use force, neither side regards him as a warrior president. In other words, progressives are slavishly supportive of one of the most military, aggressive American leaders in decades because they have deluded themselves in denying this reality and continue to pretend he's some sort of anti-war figure. That's not unreasonable speculation, but I ultimately don't believe that's true. Leaving aside Bergen's overgeneralizing of this, some factions on the left have been quite vocal in condemning Obama's actions in these areas. Most Democrats are perfectly aware of Obama's military aggression. They don't support him despite that, but rather that's one of the things they love about Obama. The left loves, after years of being mocked by the right as terrorist-coddling weaklings, Obama strutting around touting his own strength lets him feel strong and powerful in exactly the way Bush and Cheney swaggering let conservatives prance around as tough guy play-acting warriors. Rather than ignore this aggression, Democratic think tanks point with beaming pride that the corpses piled up by the Democratic commander-in-chief to argue that he's been such a resounding foreign policy success, while Democratic pundits celebrate and defend the political value of his majestic kills. Yesterday on his MSNBC morning show, Chris Hayes conducted an excellent two-part discussion of Obama's escalated civilian killing drone attacks, with a heavy emphasis on the innocent people, including numerous children who had been killed. He showed a harrowing clip of a Yemeni man anguished as he describes the pregnant woman and children killed by Obama's 2009 cluster bomb strike, featuring the U.S. drone killing one 16-year-old American citizen, and interviewed human rights lawyer Clive Smith, who describes the 16-year-old Pakistani boy he met at a meeting to discuss civilian drone deaths and who a mere 3 days later had his own life ended by an American drone. Later that day, Hayes tweeted this, quote, a bit taken aback by the ugliness that drone conversation seems to bring out in some people. What he meant was the avalanche of anger Twitter accounts attacks from steadfast Obama loyalists who gleefully defended the drone program, mocked concerns over civilian deaths, and insisted that he should not be covering such matters because they may harm Obama in an election year. Contrary to Bergen's generous belief that progressives are deluding themselves about Obama's militarism, many are fully aware of it, and because it's a Democrat doing it, have become aggressively supportive of it. That, without a doubt, will be one of Obama's most endearing legacies, transforming these policies of excessive militarism, rampant secrecy, and civil liberties assaults from right-wing radicalism into robust bipartisan consensus. Now, there is one element of delusion to Democratic support of Obama's militarism and it plagues not only his most ardent supporters, but also Bergen's co-op. Most Democratic praise for Obama foreign policy successes fails even to acknowledge, let alone condemn, the thousands of innocent people whose lives have been extinguished by his militarism. These deaths simply do not exist in their world. When you force them to address it, they simply dismiss it away with military terminology first popularized at the beginning of the Gulf War as collateral damage, and then quickly return to the Bush-era mantra of mindlessly invoking the word terrorism to justify whatever violence U.S. government commits. They see themselves, and especially their leader, as so righteous and noble that incidents like this and this and this and so many others are blissfully kept away from their consciousness because the reality of what they support cannot be reconciled with their self-perception. That, and more than anything, is what explains the bitterness directed at Hayes yesterday. He publicized facts that they desperately prefer to hide, not just from others, but from themselves. Now, here is just one challenge I offer to what I consider an otherwise very insightful comment from Glenn Greenwald, who I have a lot of respect for. This is to Glenn and a lot of people in the left and Democratic movements. Please consider before using the word progressives that understand what a real progressive is. Let me tell you who condemns Obama and all war and all drone attacks and has from the beginning condemned the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan and before that Vietnam and Grenada and everywhere else and the evisceration of our rights and torture and rendition. Not once praising, not once accepting that it's okay because it's a Democrat. Robert Reich, distinguished University of California professor, Dean Baker, economist, Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, Tom Engelhardt, Gerald Salante, Michael Hudson, Rabbi Michael Lerner, David Swanson, Ralph Nader, Jeremy Shahill, William Black, Paul Craig Roberts, Naomi Prinz, economist at Davos, Jim Garrison, Media Benjamin from Code Pink, Ray McGovern, Marjorie Cohen, former head of the National Lawyers Guild, Peter Dale Scott, Michael Rupert, Barbara Ehrenreich, Henry Giroux, Greg Palast, Naomi Wolf, Bill McKibben, Max Kaiser, Rebecca Solnit, Michael Clare, Ellen Brown, Ross Jackson, and oh, did we forget someone that never ends up getting on to the alternative and left media? How about third-party candidates who are more legitimate in their concerns, more populist in their actual belief systems than ever any of these Democrats or Republicans are? Rocky Anderson, Dennis Kucinich, Alan Grayson, Jill Stein of the Green Party. Now, these are real progressives. And I could add 5,000 more names to that list. And unfortunately, the left has co-opted some of the comment about progressives. You never used to hear. You'd hear left socialists, left communists, left anarchists, left Marxist, but you wouldn't hear left progressive. And that's one of the reasons that we founded Progressive Radio Network, for people who didn't feel comfortable trying to be something in a movement that really didn't represent their interest. So for Glenn Greenwald and all the others, there's a big difference between someone on the left, a liberal, and a progressive. I'm Gary Nall. Those are my thoughts. Now your turn. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And I will hold my other two commentaries on Environmentalism Has Failed from David Suzuki, with a brilliant essay on Biocentric View as Needed, and Our Country is Being Fracked by the Merger of Government and Big Business from Naked Capitalism. We're going to take a break, come back. We're going to go to our guest, come back, take your calls, Luann Panessi, and from our own staff in New York, we'll be hearing from Myron, our social media director. Please stay with us.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good. So good. I got a year. Wow! I feel nice. A sugar and spice. I feel nice. like sugar and spice. So nice, so nice, I got you.
I'd like to welcome all of you to our program. Nice to have you with us. For our newsmaker segment, now we're going to go to California in the Bay Area and say hello to Dr. Martha Herbert. I gave you her bio a little earlier in the program, assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and a pediatric neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And she got her medical degree from Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, has a doctorate in evolution and history of consciousness from the University of California, Santa Cruz. And she is also the author of The Autism Revolution. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Herbert.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Herbert, up until this time, we have been led to believe that the cause of autism spectrum disorder is genetics, hardwired genetics, one that we have to accept, and therefore their approach is that this is the way it is. Even though there's 1 in 88 children suffering from it, they'll say, well, it was probably this long ago, we just couldn't diagnose it then. And I say nonsense. Then where are all the adults with autism spectrum disorder? If we miss the diagnosis, we'd see it as they grew older. We don't. Also, it's a big problem worldwide. 9 million cases of autism spectrum disorder in China, 1 in 50 in the UK. And also, there's been no emphasis whatsoever in the orthodox approach to prevention or to a more natural, non-toxic or dietary whole-body approach. Could you take us through what your research and what your experience has shown could challenge some of the pre-existing issues about autism?
Well, sure. First of all, the genetics piece is coming apart. Genetics is showing less impact on the overall picture than would have been predicted. There are de novo mutations, which means mutations that kids have that their parents don't have, which are probably coming from environment. You can't just call them spontaneous. So there are things pointing to environment. There are the largest twin study done to date pointed to a larger role for environment than ever before. But really, the key thing for me is that, number one, we're seeing that the ways the kids are medically ill, and I said medically, not just genetically in the brain, are very much related to being vulnerable to the environment. And number two, people are getting better through nutritional and approaches to support these systems. And to me, that's low-hanging fruit. That's something that we could have a powerful public health program right now, which could take down the numbers and start preventing new cases.
And how would that be?
What, do you mean how we reorganize the program, or how would it work biologically?
Biologically.
Well, one of the key misunderstandings I think we have is that we have been so wedded to this idea that it's a hardwired disorder of the brain, that we've only looked at things as if that were already true. We never tested it. We never said, is it a hardwired disorder of the brain? And meanwhile, even our hardcore scientists are being shaken in their beliefs about that right now. Two particular ways. One of them is this phenomenon of kids getting better during fevers. That shouldn't happen if it's totally hardwired. And number two, a number of mouse models have been constructed where we've reversed genetic syndromes by intervention that were considered lifelong irreversible. So what I think is going on is that the brain signaling, the synapses and the glial networks, are basically, to put it bluntly, messed up by metabolic and immune and toxic compromise. And when you reduce that problem, when you reduce the load and the compromise in the whole system, the brain can get to re-equilibrate and go to a healthier balance, a healthier homeostasis, to use a technical term.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Right now, children and pregnant moms are subject to a larger onslaught of pollutants and chemicals, including drugs, than ever before in history. Simultaneously, autism spectrum disorder only increases and is not abated in the least, now 1 in 88. Wouldn't you think at some point that we would pull back and look at all environmental exposures and those who may be more susceptible, because no two people are equally susceptible, both and then start at least examining the environment and diet and chemicals and heavy metals instead of washing it all aside and saying none of that is important?
Well, yeah, I totally agree with you. I wrote a blog a couple of weeks ago on the Autism Speak site about total load, that it's the total load of all of these different insults combined with the inadequate support from our nutrient-poor, compromised nutritional food supply that together both causes lots of insults and doesn't give us what we need to protect ourselves. The problem I have right now is with academics are going to try and search one by one for all the different chemicals and which one might cause autism. I don't think that's the right approach. I really think that there are so many different things that can deplete our core detox systems, our core biochemical processes, our core ability to make energy, that we need to be much broader about it, and we need to be much more aggressive in protecting our biology and supporting it aggressively, really aggressively. One of my friends in Canada, Steve Genuis, who's become involved in this, who's written some brilliant things on detox and just reviewing it in simple language for people to understand, talks about nutrient flooding. I really like that term because it's simple and direct. We don't know exactly which nutrients a person is going to need, and we're not going to know in any ultimately precise way. But to pile on green smoothies and lots of fruits and vegetables of high quality, organic if possible, is really an important way of at least giving the body the substrate it needs to start repairing stuck biochemical processes that are right now hanging up the works.
Good insight. By the way, just to give you one example from today, a new scientific article by a Dr. Angus, emeritus professor, and at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Dorothy Caputa, state that they have discovered a common insecticide, quote, may have impact on the developing brains by irreversibly changing its structure. And this according to a case-controlled study of children. Now, Since this was, by the way, presented in the National Academy of Sciences, proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and yet we are not doing anything nationally to put a red flag up about how polluted our environment can be and to warn people about don't be using these, you know, like even fly strips in rooms that have pesticides on them when a baby's in the crib. I think we need a renaissance in environmental awareness. Final thoughts from you, please.
Yeah, we need that. I think New York passed a bill that you can't spray in schoolyards. I think everybody should have that bill, and we should have it much more broadly.
Well, thank you for the good work that you're doing. The book is The Autism Revolution, Whole Body Strategies for Making Life All It Can Be, Dr. Martha Stewart. Website
Martha Herbert.
Sorry. Website autismrevolution.org. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And by the way, just what's nice is she's coming from a very strong academic background at Harvard Medical School. And let's now also say hello to Julie Matthews, who I gave you her background a little earlier, is certified nutritional consultant specializing in helping people with autism spectrum disorder. Nice to have you with us today, Julie.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Julie, tell us about the approach that you take. And Julie's book is called Nourishing Hope for Autism, Nutrition Intervention for Healing Our Children. Very good book, very concise. Julie, give us your best few examples of what you believe would help the children who are diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder.
Yes. As Dr. Martha Herbert was saying, these kids have biological things going on. So when we can choose foods and avoid foods that can help reduce inflammation, that can help provide these nutrients that they so desperately need for all these toxic exposures, we see some pretty profound changes. So gluten, the protein in wheat, and dairy, the protein in that called casein, these can actually create opiates, which we've found can really affect language and areas of behavior. We know that artificial ingredients create hyperactivity in typical developing children. It certainly can have a really profound effect and have really significant behavior and other factors for children on the autism spectrum. So it's about getting out inflammatory foods, adding all this good nutrient density to get those biochemical pathways working better, using some targeted supplementation when maybe we need to support a pathway that's not working so well, and get all the artificial junk out that's just burdening our system that is causing a lot of problems we certainly don't need.
Good summary. Get rid of the gluten, get rid of the dairy, good nutritional therapy by a physician that understands detoxification, and that is the way to go. I absolutely agree with that. That's what I do. Did you ever have a chance to see Autism Made in the USA?
Yes, I have. In fact, I think I might have a little tiny clip in there.
You do.
It's excellent.
Just want to make sure you saw it. Because there we had a whole group of physicians, medical doctors, whose own children are improving now that they understand the power of cleansing and detoxing. Julie, thank you for your good work. Julie Matthews, the book is called Nourishing Hope for Autism, Nutrition Intervention for Healing Our Children. The website is nourishinghope.com. And Dr. Martha Herbert, Autism Revolution, autismrevolution.org. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you both very much. Now let's go over and say hello to Luann Panassi, who is standing by. And Luann, I'm on the road. And Luann takes all your emails and letters and selects the ones that are important, and she asks, and then I'll address them. Hi, Luann.
Hi, Gary. I'm here in the studio today. I've gotten a number of emails from your listeners, and I have an anonymous woman from New Jersey who said that she's been listening to you on Progressive Radio Network since it started about 7 years ago when you left BAI. And she came back to BAI when you came back.
Good.
And last August, she ordered three premiums, and one of them was for a friend with cancer. The problem is she never got the premiums. She wrote letters, she called, she emailed, and then after the 5th month, she called you. Apparently, you gave them all of the premiums for free. And when she came out of the office, she looked back and she saw cases upon cases of premiums with BAI's name on them. After that experience, she now only listens to PRN. It's as if, she says, it's as if BAI seems willing to have you pitch for them and support them, and yet they don't support you back by delivering your premiums at anywhere on time. Now, she says she's very aware that WBAI is having a rough time, but quite frankly, when you're talking about people with cancer and other illnesses where your DVDs are going to help them significantly, it's just no excuse. She states that her career is in corporate research. And one of the things is that she saw the ratings. WBAI has hundreds of listeners when they should have hundreds of thousands. And at this point, they're running out of listeners. Yet, your ratings are superb. If you go up to independent, liberal, or progressive radio ratings, you have more listeners on PRN than all of Pacifica's listeners combined. And she says you'd think they'd get a little more socially relevant programs and honor their pledges. So, P.S., she says, her friend is doing very well since she gave her the cancer DVD. And she also wanted to let you know that she and her friend and her husband were there at Indian Point, and she was there at the rally in Brooklyn and at the governor's office against hydrofracking. And once again, this is an independent listener. She says no one from BAI was there in terms of producers, people, that, other people that have shows. And she feels at this point BAI needs to give up their hypocrisy. And I'm going to tell you, Gary, I was on the local station board at WBAI. My personal opinion is that it's a lot of flavor about self-importance. And unfortunately, they've just missed the boat. When you have emails like this coming in, this is just one of many. And
well, we only need to hear one. So I have no problem with you saying something that is critical. We don't censor, and that is certainly the view of many people out there. So, but let me address it, and let me address it a little differently. First, let me say thank you to the people who did show up. Steve Brown from the local station board, Mitchell Cohen, the president of the local station board, Michael G. Haskins, always there for important progressive cause. He was there in front of the governor's office. So we did have three people. Now, mind you, there were no producers, there were no hosts, there were none of the people at the station nor the management there, and that's their right, because they have their own issues they want to address. But I would look at this a little differently. Here's how I'd look at it. That BAI is going through a transition. They even have a new program director starting in a month. And with that, they'll probably have some new programs. The station board is filled with individuals who care deeply about the station. They're not paid. They get in big arguments. They take that energy home. And why do they do that? Why do they subject themselves to arguments? Because they fear what happens if everyone gives up on BAI and then it no longer is a voice that would challenge. There was times in our history where BAI was the only activist voice that dared stand against the enormous industries and governmental agencies like the FBI. The idea is today that there's unlimited resources we can go to. There's no shortage of places for relevant information, whether it's biased or subjective or objective. There's lots of resources. We're not the only game. My hope is, my desire is to help BAI through this audience, through our programming, through our listener support, align itself with progressive causes. You have some extraordinarily articulate, intelligent, insightful host, producers, and people in the system. Mrs. Summers, who's the president of the board, one of the most brilliant, insightful, caring, and nurturing individuals you're going to find anywhere in the media. But she's one person. One person is frequently met with the challenge of those who want to hold on to jobs or hold on their positions who are not equally qualified. Not everyone does great programming. Not everyone is great managers. Not everyone's great insight. No, not everyone has got the mind to see what the public needs and provide that and be a leader in it and be out there in front of it. But things are changing. And in all changes, you go through transformative steps. Understand that it'll probably take BAI and Pacifica another 2 years before they finally reemerge as the voice of the people in a unified way, where you will have people working together to show up at rallies and support one another and cross-promote one another on their programs and mention other programs, not just their own, that people should listen to. It'll take time, but don't give up on it. It's worth saving. If it wasn't, I wouldn't be here. I'm not paid. But and there's a lot of mockery and jealousy, and I just accept that, and it doesn't bother me at all. Because I see how many people are there at the rallies who are writing. Do you think this law in California would have gotten through without our listeners? Absolutely not. But we distinguish our listeners are progressive listeners, not just left listeners. We have as many conservative and libertarian people listening and supporting these causes as we do the left. So we don't identify with an ideology or ideologues. We're not here to protect a president or condemn a president. We're here to talk about what is and what can be and should be. And that's why we've provided a forum for Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson, because these are voices that deserve to be respected, not defending, because we're card-carrying, you know, Republican or Democrat. So BAI simply has to decide what it wants to be, and it hasn't. Pacifica has to decide what kind of network do we want to be. They once knew, but now they don't. Individuals have to decide, are they going to work together or against each other so nothing gets done? Up to this point, it's been a lot of conflict, a lot of incompetence, a lot of unprofessionalism. And yes, indeed, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people waited 6 months to get their premiums, and that is unforgivable. And I'm sorry for that. But I can't tell management what to do. It's got to make giving the premiums a priority. If you only saw the emails, if you were in the rooms and conversations, I said, please make supplying the premiums immediately the first priority, because your audience should be your first priority. That hasn't happened yet, but hopefully it will. And hopefully it'll be consistent. When I came back, it was that. So my goal for BAI and Pacifica is work together for common causes that we all could support. Work together on environmental issues, on human rights issues. Work together with the people out there who don't even have a voice or a forum, but have good intents and are willing to commit themselves to the common good. Bring new voices on board. Let the public see what a diversity of thoughts and great minds we have in this country, instead of the same old, same old, same old. Why do you think that when you watch MSNBC and Fox and Current TV, you see the same people over and over again? None of them, not one of them, is progressive. They're either left or right in varying degrees. If they're too far in the independent mind, they're excluded. As long as they can continue to support, although sometimes slightly challenging, the power it be, they still get a seat at the table. The people we need at the table of the American citizens are people who to throw all these people out the door and start from scratch. And maybe that's what's needed. Maybe we just need a clean sweep and start from scratch. And I will be the first to volunteer my space and my time. I would ask no one to go before me. I'd in a heartbeat say goodbye. If you can find someone, bring them in here, offering new voices, new support, new direction, new dimension to save this. And sometimes we have to make these sacrifices if we want what we cherish to go forward. I don't want to talk about this again. So we've dealt with this. Hopefully people understand where I stand. I believe that Pacifica and I believe BAI is worth saving. I only wish they had the same cooperative spirit at the local station boards, at the national board, at the individual producing board, and then hold standards so high that only those who really are willing to work for a larger and common good get the jobs. And as long as anyone has any job in a system that they did not deserve and are not up to, that will limit how far everyone else is able to go forward in that area. And that's been a common and endemic problem as long as I've been on Pacifica. Hope that answers the question. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Someone's arms and they